I'm John Strum, and this is Real Talk MS. It's Thursday, September 17th, and welcome to a special episode of Real Talk MS. This past weekend, 8,000 MS research scientists and clinicians gathered virtually for the joint meeting of the America's Committee for Treatment and Research in Multiple Sclerosis and the European Committee for Treatment and Research in Multiple Sclerosis. Known as ECTRIMS, this year's conference was appropriately rebranded as MS Virtual 2020, while still maintaining its reputation as the largest MS research conference in the world. The conference got underway with a presentation on the MS Prodrome by Dr. Helen Tremlett, a professor and Canada research chair in neuroepidemiology and multiple sclerosis at the University of British Columbia. Dr. Tremlett concluded her presentation saying, "It is time that the prodromal phase of multiple sclerosis is recognized." So let's take a minute to define what that means. The word prodrome actually comes from the Greek word prodromos, which means running before. And in medicine, a prodrome is a sign or symptom or a set of signs or symptoms that indicates the onset of a disease before diagnostically specific symptoms develop. In 2018, Dr. Tremlett and her team analyzed patient data from four Canadian provinces, including 14,000 people living with MS and 75,000 matched healthy controls. And the research team found that in the 5 years before the first demyelinating event among the MS patients, there was a 75% increase in the rate of hospitalization, an 88% increase in the use of physician services, and a 49% increase in prescription medications compared with the control group. There was a 50% increase in mental health appointments and increased rates of fibromyalgia, pain, headache, migraine, sleep disturbances, urological symptoms, and referrals to dermatologists. That's quite a list of symptoms. And when the research team looked at another population study of 10,000 patients with MS and a control group of 39,000 people in the United Kingdom, they found an increase in gastrointestinal issues, urinary issues, pain, anxiety, depression, insomnia, and fatigue 10 years before the first MS diagnosis. Dr. Tremlett pointed to a Norwegian military study that included 900 male MS patients and 19,000 healthy controls and found that cognitive performance was reduced 2 years before MS symptoms developed and up to 20 years before symptoms developed among those men who developed primary progressive MS. So clearly there seems to be something here. But nothing specific to MS. Many of these same symptoms precede other neurological conditions. So there's a lot more work to be done by the research community in identifying a specific MS prodrome. But being able to identify someone who is likely to develop MS years ahead of time may one day give clinicians an opportunity to intervene with disease-modifying therapies that will prevent MS from ever complicating that person's life. And that seems like a worthwhile path to explore. One of the themes that was repeated during the conference was the impact of aging on MS. And as we've said before, as the MS population continues to age, you can expect to see and hear more research being focused on the effects of aging on MS and the effects of MS on aging. Dr. John Corboy, a professor and vice chair of neurology at the University of Colorado School of Medicine and the co-director of the Rocky Mountain MS Center at the University of Colorado, gave a presentation that asked the question, when is it appropriate to discontinue disease-modifying therapy in multiple sclerosis? And as you might imagine, this was a presentation that focused on the use, or more specifically, the discontinuation of the use of disease-modifying therapies as people living with MS continue to age. Dr. Corboy made the point that there isn't a lot of data here because people over the age of 55 are routinely excluded from most clinical trials. But he did share evidence that showed that MS relapses and changes in MRI scans diminish with age and are substantially lower in people over the age of 50. Dr. Corboy also pointed to data that showed that MS disease-modifying therapies are much more effective in younger adults. However, he also pointed to data that showed that people over the age of 55 were overwhelmingly reluctant to discontinue their disease-modifying therapies, even without evidence to support that position. And clearly, evidence is what's needed here. So Dr. Corboy is in the midst of heading up a study that is specifically looking at the effects of discontinuing disease-modifying therapy among people over the age of 55 who have not had an MS relapse for at least 5 years, have shown no changes in their MRI scan in at least 3 years, and have continuously been taking their disease-modifying therapy over that period of time. And you can be sure that we'll be talking more about that study in the near future as Dr. Corboy's team begins to publish their results. Over the past few years, we've seen more research focused on progressive MS than perhaps ever before. And there was some encouraging news reported during MS Virtual 2020. French biotech company AB Science reported the results of its Phase 3 study showing that masitinib slowed disability progression in people with primary progressive MS and non-active secondary progressive MS. And this is encouraging news for a few different reasons. First, when you talk about people living with primary progressive MS and non-active secondary progressive MS, you're talking about 50% of all the people living with multiple sclerosis. So the potential impact of this therapy could be really meaningful. And masitinib represents a new approach to treating progressive MS. Many experts believe that the innate immune system plays a role in progressive MS, and masitinib is unique in that it targets the innate immune system, as opposed to targeting adaptive immune cells, like the B cells and T cells that are familiar to people already receiving MS disease-modifying therapies. What's more interesting is that masitinib has actually been available in Europe since 2009, but not to humans. It's been marketed under the name Masivet, and it's been used as a treatment for mast cell tumors in dogs. Masitinib is an oral therapy, and the theory behind its efficacy is that by targeting cells in the innate immune system, the drug is limiting the inflammatory processes that destroy myelin. The next step for AB Science is a study to confirm the results that they've already observed. This confirmatory study will involve 700 people with primary progressive or non-active secondary progressive MS, and scientists will be focused on disability progression based on EDSS and MRI measurements. Of course, we'll be following this study and we'll keep you updated as new information is reported. Coinciding with the MS Virtual 2020 conference, the MS International Federation released the Atlas of MS, the most extensive global MS prevalence study to date, and it shows the number of people living with MS has increased in every region of the world. I had an opportunity to connect with the MS International Federation's Claire Walton to discuss the Atlas of MS, and in a moment, we'll hear my conversation with Claire Walton. This past week, the MS International Federation released the Atlas of MS, the MS International Federation's most accurate estimate to date of the number of people living with multiple sclerosis around the world. And the new numbers indicate that every 5 minutes, somewhere in the world, someone is diagnosed with MS. We're talking with Claire Walton from the MS International Federation, and welcome to the podcast, Claire.
Thanks, John. I'm happy to be here.
Well, let's get right to the news. What does the Atlas of MS tell us?
So the Atlas of MS is a very large epidemiological study of MS around the world. And by that, I mean the numbers of MS. So who is developing it? Where are they developing it? What type of MS are they developing? And how is that changing over time? We also ask about availability and access of resources, but that is in this edition still to be released. So we will be releasing that in the next couple of months. So what we can talk about now is the numbers, because that's what we've just launched.
And what was the new prevalence number?
So the new, we now estimate that there are 2.8 million people living with MS worldwide, and this has increased in every region of the world. So every WHO region, it has gone up since 2013. Now, our data cannot tell us why it's gone up, but it is in line with many national studies that have taken place over the same period or a similar period. And we think from those studies that the main reasons are because diagnosis is better, and it's diagnosis is gradually taking place earlier. Of course, also people are living longer due to generally increasing lifespan, but also due to disease modifying treatments being used, which are extending lifespan. And then also we're just counting a lot better. There's many more registries around the world, and our methods for tracking and recording people getting a diagnosis of MS has improved. So when you bring all these together, that's why we think the number appears to be going up in pretty much every country that we looked at.
I'm wondering, were you able to determine how many of the 2.8 million people were living with relapsing remitting MS and how many were living with progressive MS?
That's actually a very difficult question to answer. So what we were able to collect was those proportions on diagnosis. So we know that about 85% of people are diagnosed with relapsing remitting, and about 12% are diagnosed with progressive, and 3% were undefined. But what we are still working on is the proportions of people currently living, because obviously that changes as people progress to secondary progressive. And we had some concerns with some of the data that we received, so we didn't include it in this report. We did really thorough data collection and checking this time around, and so we didn't include it, and we are going back to all of our country coordinators who reported data to just double check everyone is using the same definitions, and that data will be reported later.
Was it possible for you to determine how many of these 2.8 million people living with MS are actually under the age of 18?
Yeah. So we asked about pediatric prevalence and also incidence. Very few countries could report on incidence, so the number of people being diagnosed under the age of 18 each year, but prevalence was reported in, I think, 51 countries, and we now know there are at least 30,000 people living with MS under the age of 18 worldwide. This is likely to be a huge underestimation because, as I said, only 51 countries reported on it. But it has gone up a lot since we last asked when we did the Atlas of MS in 2013. And again, we think that is due to increasing understanding of the fact that children can develop MS. And so more people are diagnosing and reporting it than they were 7 years ago.
So given these new numbers, what did you calculate as the average age for someone being diagnosed with MS somewhere in the world?
So the average age is 32 years, and that was fairly consistent across the different world regions, but there is a huge range seen across all the countries that reported, ranging from 20 years all the way up to 50 years as the mean, you know, the average for the country. So I think that tells us that diagnosis processes and when people are receiving their diagnosis is quite different from country to country.
Claire, can you talk a little bit about the methodology that was used for arriving at this new number of 2.8 million people?
Yes. So we improved our methodology a lot this year. In previous editions, so the Atlas of MS was launched in 2008 with the WHO, and we used a method where we reach out to every country and we ask them to tell us their best data on prevalence. But of course, many countries don't have any data, so there's gaps. And so what we've done in the past is we've filled those gaps by using the global median prevalence rate and applying that to the populations of all the countries that don't have reported prevalence. And that gives you the global estimate. But this year, we realized that the vast majority of countries that don't have prevalence data are in Africa or are low income countries. And these countries have a markedly lower prevalence than the global median. So actually, by the old methodology was really overestimating the prevalence in these countries. And that was therefore inflating our global estimate. So this year we calculated sub-region prevalence for different world regions based on the data that had been reported. And then we use those sub-regional rates to estimate the prevalence in the countries that had gaps. And by doing that, we've reached our most accurate estimate of the global number to date.
Well, I'm hoping you can clarify something that I'm a little bit confused by. Up until last week, when the MSIF announced the 2.8 million people around the world that were living with MS, the old number had been 2.3 million. Then last year, the National MS Society announced a new prevalence number for people living with MS in the United States. In the United States alone, we saw our number increase by 500,000. So if I start with 2.3 million worldwide, and I add the additional 500,000 people living just in the United States, well, that brings me to 2.8 million people. But that would also imply that MS prevalence stayed exactly the same everywhere else in the world. And I clearly heard you say a moment ago that it had gone up. So help me here.
So that, yes, exactly. That's just, it speaks to the answer I just gave to your last question, in that we've changed our methodology this year, and we think previous estimates were overestimates in the areas of the world that have really low or missing data. If we repeated the methodology we used in 2008 and 2013, we would have come up with a global figure of 3 million, which is more aligned with what you might expect from, as you've just done, kind of tallying up increases that we know about in different countries. But, you know, we are confident that that is an overestimation and that the 2.8 million is more accurate because of our improved methodology. We're lucky this year to have an in-kind donation from the National MS Society in the US to work with some epidemiology consultants who actually worked on the US revision of the US prevalence. And they worked with us to develop this improved methodology. So that's why you can't just do the maths in the way you just did. But it does mean we're more confident in the estimate that we're now using.
Well, I think if you go back several decades and check with some of my early teachers, they will all confirm that I cannot do math. So I'm not surprised at your answer. What do you think this new number of 2.8 million families living with MS all around the world, what does it mean? What does it do? I guess more specifically, I'm asking, how can we use this number to raise awareness and focus greater resources on treating, managing, and researching multiple sclerosis?
Yeah, it's a great question, John. I think the key is that, you know, without data to tell us who's living with MS, where, what their needs are, we can't underpin advocacy efforts with evidence. So it's really important that we have this picture so that we can work with governments to make sure the right healthcare is provided at the right time in the right format. So we really urge everyone to help us use this data. In the first way, we want to fill the gaps. So there are many gaps around the world that still exist around the evidence we have. And with our new Atlas, instead of the way we've worked before, where we update it every kind of 5 years, we're building in the ability to update it more regularly. So if you spot gaps on the Atlas, on the website, and you know some data exists, please reach out to us, because we want to make it the best and most useful resource for the community that we can, so that people can use it in their advocacy work, in their healthcare planning, to raise awareness of the situation and the challenges that these 2.8 million families are facing.
You just mentioned the gaps that still exist around the world. In some countries, the outreach of the MS International Federation is the only outreach, the only information that people affected by MS ever receive. So I'm very grateful for the work that the MS International Federation does all around the world. And Claire Walton, thanks for taking a few minutes to talk with me today.
Thanks very much, John.
Last week on Real Talk MS, we devoted an entire episode of the podcast to a conversation that I had with Johns Hopkins neurologist Dr. Scott Newsom, where we took a deep dive into MS disease-modifying therapies. And this week at the MS Virtual 2020 conference, I saw a presentation by Dr. Mattia Fondarico of the University of Florence in Italy, and Dr. Fondarico's presentation was entitled Disease-Modifying Treatment May Delay Time to Wheelchair in Primary Progressive Multiple Sclerosis. And if you're looking for one more piece of evidence to reinforce the idea that starting MS disease-modifying therapy early provides a better outcome, well, this presentation was for you. Dr. Fondarico and his team analyzed real-world clinical data from over 1,200 people living with primary progressive MS, whose records were part of an Italian MS registry. And their analysis concluded that longer exposure to disease-modifying therapies may delay disability progression and delay the time until people with primary progressive MS required a wheelchair. The data also suggested that starting MS disease-modifying therapy at a younger age, shortly after the onset of MS, can actually improve patients' long-term clinical outcomes. And so the message remains clear. Make sure you're on a disease-modifying therapy, and the sooner the better, and then stay on it. Now, that doesn't mean that the specific medication can't change over time, but you're doing your future self a tremendous service by taking these steps today. There's no shortage of online information about the effects of diet on MS, and too much of the time that information ends up being someone's opinion masquerading as fact. So there's been real interest in a study that's compared two so-called MS diets, the Walls diet and the Swank diet. The study involved just over 70 people living with relapsing-remitting MS, and it measured the impact of these two diets on MS-related fatigue, overall quality of life, processing speed, and walking abilities. The study results were announced at the MS Virtual 2020 conference, and both diets demonstrated benefits in reducing MS-related fatigue. There was also some improvement in quality of life in terms of both physical health and mental health. So choosing to eat a healthy diet is one more lifestyle change that you can make that is likely going to deliver benefits to managing your MS and helping to improve your overall quality of life. And you'll gain those benefits without the need of expensive prescription medications, which sounds like some very good news. At last year's ECTRIMS conference, I shared news about a stem cell clinical trial that was about to get underway from Atara Biotherapeutics. The trial was designed to measure the effectiveness of ATA188, an off-the-shelf cell therapy designed to attack B cells in the immune system that have been infected with the Epstein-Barr virus. And this past week, Atara Biotherapeutics was back to announce some initial data from their Phase 1 study. I had an opportunity to reconnect with Dr. A.J. Joshi, the Senior Vice President and Chief Medical Officer at Atara Biotherapeutics, to review their clinical trial measuring the benefit of ATA 188 for people living with primary progressive and secondary progressive MS. In a moment, we'll hear my conversation with Dr. A.J. Joshi. If you're a longtime listener, you might remember that last fall at the ECTRIMS conference, I met up with Dr. A.J. Joshi, the Senior Vice President and Chief Medical Officer at Atara Biotherapeutics, and we talked about ATA 188, which is Atara Biotherapeutics' cell therapy that's designed to attack B cells in the immune system that have been infected with the Epstein-Barr virus. There are many experts who believe that if you can eliminate the Epstein-Barr virus, you can eliminate most multiple sclerosis. And that's the theory behind this ATA 188 treatment, that attacking the Epstein-Barr virus is a viable path to mitigating MS. Atara Biotherapeutics clinical trial is specifically looking at the benefit of ATA 188 for people living with primary progressive and secondary progressive MS. So welcome back to the podcast, Dr. Joshi.
Oh, thank you so much for having me, John. Really great to be back.
Well, last year at ECTRIMS, we had a conversation explaining what ATA 188 cell therapy is all about. But I know that there are a lot of people listening who've joined the Real Talk MS listener community since then. So just to bring everyone up to speed, would you mind explaining what an off-the-shelf allogeneic T-cell immunotherapy actually is?
Sure. So maybe I'll start with a quick point about the Epstein-Barr virus, because it'll explain what T-cell therapy is going to do. So Epstein-Barr virus, the way it's thought to be connected to multiple sclerosis is, once you're infected with the Epstein-Barr virus, and just so you know, 100% of MS patients actually have been infected with the Epstein-Barr virus. The newer studies are showing that you almost have to have Epstein-Barr virus to develop multiple sclerosis. And what happens when you get the infection is it actually stays in your system. You never really get rid of it. It goes into the B cells in your body and kind of hides out there. And that's a really important point, because you might have heard of, I'm sure the listeners have heard of, a lot of the therapies for multiple sclerosis that focus on attacking the B cells and eliminating them to try to control multiple sclerosis symptoms. The difference with what we're trying to do with a targeted cell therapy like we have now with ATA 188 is we want to only eliminate the B cells that have been infected by Epstein-Barr virus, because we believe those are the ones that are actually causing the problem. Now, how do you do that? Well, what we do with ATA 188 is we actually get healthy donors, and we take their T cells, and then we essentially get those T cells really trained up to be able to recognize and attack cells that have Epstein-Barr virus infection. And then we take all of those cells and put them in an inventory. So then if a patient, if a person living with MS is looking to get into one of our clinical trials, and we're going to put them on therapy, we just get their immune profile. So all it is, we just get a blood test, and we're able to see the patient's immune profile. And then we match that immune profile to the right ATA 188, and then we're able to administer that just by an intravenous injection. And I should have mentioned a little bit earlier, when I say AT-188, all AT-188 is essentially those T cells that I mentioned, healthy donor T cells, that are able to fight that Epstein-Barr virus infection. And we make sure that when we deliver that cell therapy to for someone who's living with MS, it's matched to their immune system so that it works as well as possible for that individual person.
So now we're back, at least virtually back, at ECTRIMS, and this year, Atara Biotherapeutics is making some announcements. So can you share the news with us?
Sure. So we're really reporting on additional information from the first study that we talked, from the study we first discussed back to last ECTRIMS. And what's happened is we have treated a lot more patients since we had treated them with ATA 188. And we've also got a longer observation period. And the really big thing that we're trying to focus in on is this concept of improving disability. So as you mentioned before, we are studying people living with primary progressive and secondary progressive MS in this trial. And what, as you know, for most people living with progressive MS, you're going to get a worsening of your disability over time. Even with some of the best therapies that are out there, they're really able to slow the worsening of disability. What we're trying to do with this therapy is actually say, well, you know what? Can we actually reverse the disability? Can we make it better? Now, that's a big order, as you know, because really no other therapies have been able to do that. And our data are early. We have, there's a total of 24 patients, and I think everyone knows that really for a MS program, you want lots of patients and you want controlled trials. All that said, we have some very interesting information that's coming out of the study in terms of this disability improvement. What we did in the trial was we had four different doses that we used, and we noticed that we had disability improvement in people at each one of those doses. What was more interesting, though, was the higher dose cohort. So these are our cohorts 3 and 4. The higher dose group actually had more disability improvement than the lower dose group. And when you look at the most important time point for us within this trial, which is 12 months, meaning 12 months after you started in the trial, it's 12 months after your first, dose of APA-188, at that 12-month time point, 5 out of 12 patients in the highest dose cohort actually had disability improvement. And that was, from our perspective, that was actually a very significant number. Now, again, it's an open label study. It's not a control study. And everyone would ultimately like to see a control study to make sure that that finding is real. But that said, the magnitude of that benefit was a lot more than I think most people expected we would be able to see.
So when we talk about progressive MS, whether it's primary progressive mm-hmm. or secondary progressive, and we talk about treatments, mm-hmm. as you pointed out, we often hear about delaying progression, delaying worsening, but mm-hmm. the term disability improvement is something, well, I for one have never heard. So that's, I would say, quite an initial accomplishment.
Thank you, John. We're excited about it, but we want to be measured at the same time, because just thinking about that concept, and you and I have both, I'm sure, spoken with many people who are living with MS, and we know that there's a lot of hope that comes with that concept of being able to reverse disability. So we want to do this in a very responsible way. So we've been working really closely with the thought leaders to make sure we're studying this correctly, that we're not kind of overstating some of the benefits here. So they've been really good in helping us make sure. And we've also actually spoken with people living with MS as well to try to get their advice on how we study this properly. So we've really tried to take a very respectful approach, because we know that, hope gives you significant responsibility. We can't really, we don't want to, again, as I said earlier, we don't want to overstate this. All of that said, it's exciting. Just the concept of potentially being able to reverse disability is so intriguing. And what's interesting for us is I mentioned the phase 1A study that we measured all the way out to 12 months. I should have added one other piece to it, actually, that continues to make us feel like there's something really interesting that we're seeing. We have an open label extension to that study. So people who actually completed the full 12 months are able to continue on into an extension study. And during that extension study, they're able to get redosed with APA-188 every year. And we continue to do assessments on them. And that lasts for an additional 4 years beyond the first 12 months. And we have kind of the earliest data from the first 6 patients that got into that open label extension study. And what we found to be really powerful is that no matter when you had this, we called it sustained disability improvement, is the actual measurement that we did to say somebody had improvement. And it was a pretty high bar, because we said you had to have disability improvement on, all the measures that people have probably heard about, CDSS and time 25-foot walk. It had to have an improvement on one of those measures but it had to be confirmed at two consecutive time points. So it wasn't just a random number. Once somebody had that confirmed improvement, whatever point that they had it, they've not lost it all the way through the longest observation we have. So most patients we've observed through 12 months. So if you had disability improvement, you kept it all the way through that 12-month time frame. And now these six additional patients, three of them had had disability improvement at 12 months. They have to maintain it also at that 15-month time point. And that was a very powerful piece of information for us, because you really want to make sure that what we're doing isn't kind of a transient phenomenon. It doesn't, you don't want it to help and then go away very rapidly. So the longer we're able to follow and observe and see these improvements sustained, the more excited that we get that maybe we really are seeing something real. Obviously, this will have to be kind of assessed in a randomized controlled study, which is something we've already initiated for ATA188. So we're certainly excited to get that study enrolled and really move it along so that we can hopefully see additional results coming out of it in the near future.
I was about to ask you that very question. So which MS patients can participate in your study, and how do they go about getting involved?
Sure. So the study is focused in the randomized control study, similar to the phase 1A. It's focused in on secondary progressive MS and primary progressive MS. In general, it's focused on people who don't have a lot of active disease. And the reason for that is we actually think ATA188 is going to work in both kind of active relapsing disease as well as progressive disease. But the key thing, because we're focusing in on disability here, we wanted to focus in on a group of people who don't have a lot of active disease, so we can focus on the progressive component of it. So that's the big population. So men, women, large ranges of disability, and a large age range as well. So there's a broad variety of people that would be able to participate in the study. The best way to go about it is to look at clinicaltrials.gov. And if you just type in ATA188, you'll be able to pull up the study and all the clinical sites that are available. And if people have questions that they want to reach out to the company for, they can certainly go to our website and contact us through our medical information line, and we can help provide some information that way as well.
And we'll try to make that a little easier for our listeners, and we'll just include that link in today's show notes so they'll be able to click their way right to that information about your particular study. I've talked with other researchers who are at ECTRIMS today, and and it's hard to have a conversation about anything today without having to at least acknowledge the pandemic that continues to rage here in the United States and around the world. I'm curious, has the COVID-19 pandemic impacted your trial at all?
It's a really good question. There is impact to the trial. That said, I think, the team working here, as well as the physicians and the clinicians and really the patients who were involved in the trial itself, have been amazing in coming up with really good ways to make sure that we're able to get them the treatment on time that they need, get the assessments on time, and do it in a way where everybody stays safe. So there has been impact, but I think all the measures that collectively we've come together and put into place have created a way to make sure that the trial and the information goes on, and we're able to generate the right quality information and data in a way that's safe for everyone. So I have to say I'm really humbled by the efforts that everyone has put in to make that happen. It's been amazing to see because, when it first started, to be quite honest, John, I didn't know how this was going to play out. We actually, even for a short time, suspended the randomized control study because we wanted to make sure that no one was going to be at risk. And as we, spoke with everyone and everyone came up with the right way to move forward, we were able to reopen it. And we've really jumped right into the enrollment process.
And actually, I'm hearing that often, that while there was a pause, laboratories are beginning to go back to work, research is beginning to get started again, which is great news all around. Well, Dr. A.J. Joshi, thanks for sharing some really encouraging news about this ongoing cell therapy trial in what feels like real time. And thanks for talking with me today. I'm really looking forward to our next update.
Thanks so much, John, and thanks to the listeners as well.
That's going to wrap up this special MS Virtual 2020 episode of Real Talk MS. Real Talk MS is powered by the National MS Society. And you can share this episode of the podcast by letting your friends or family members know that all they have to do is point their web browser at realtalkms.com/MSVirtual2020. You'll find that link in today's show notes, so you can easily copy and paste it right into an email or text. We'll be back next Tuesday with our regular weekly podcast episode, and in next week's episode, I'll be sitting down with the National MS Society's Executive Vice President of Research, Dr. Bruce Bebo, to get his impressions of the MS Virtual 2020 conference and the research that caught his attention. I'm John Strum. Thanks for listening. Stay safe and make healthy choices.